with you every single moment.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Ja'far, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. And His Eminence was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet. We find many proofs for the great treasure of his knowledge and wisdom. One of the great proofs of the great treasure of knowledge and wisdom of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam is that while His Eminence was still in his tender youth, the Shia jurisprudence, after the martyrdom of Imam al-Raza alayhi salam, hastened towards the city of Medina. They came to inquire as to know who is the next infallible and divinely appointed Imam. The reliable people and those who were trustworthy guided these Shia jurisprudents who had come from different places in the Islamic world towards Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. The Shia jurisprudents went to Imam al-Jawad and asked His Eminence the most ambiguous and complicated of questions. And yet Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam answered each and every one of them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues and the beautiful conversations of the divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Now, of course, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed Imam from the line of the divinely appointed Imams that trace themselves back not only in bloodline, but also as far as this chain of traditions to the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Now, one of the interesting things that we find, of course, in the conversations of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam, even though he spoke about a whole host and variety of different things, and of course he had conversations with all different kind of people from different religions, from different schools of thought within the Muslims, and even from different schools of thoughts within the Shia themselves. Now, one of the things that we face even in the present day are these kind of misfortunes or these disasters on a personal and individual level, or even these kind of calamities, trials, tribulations, you know, and hardships again on a personal and individual level. It seems like, you know, sometimes we're just having one of those days. Now, here we find, of course, that these misfortunes and disasters are of separate categories. So one category of trials and tribulations, of course, is those which come about via the Almighty Allah. And of course, their purpose is in order to elevate our status and elevate our rank as Muslims and as mu'mineen, as believers. But there's another kind of trial and tribulation and misfortune and disaster which comes about because of our negligence. For example, there are certain sins which we commit which bring about these kind of calamities and disasters, meaning it happens to us because of ourselves. It's interesting, if we ever get a chance, but Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he has a beautiful tradition where he talks to, I believe, Sufyan al-Thawri, and he says to him, he gives him three pieces of advice. One of those pieces of advice, he says, is that if you feel like your daily bread or your sustenance is being tightened and you're not receiving that sustenance as easily as you were, then do istighfar, ask Allah for forgiveness. And so even though he didn't continue, but of course you ask Allah for forgiveness, especially when you commit some sort of sin or error. So perhaps without knowing, we are committing certain things. So here Imam al-Jawad, along those same lines, of course being the grandson and the descendant of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, he says, supplication and dua to Allah discharges and gets rid of and relieves misfortunes and disasters. He says, by supplication, by dua, misfortunes are discharged. What a beautiful statement in this conversation when somebody had asked him, you know, what do we do when we are faced with misfortunes and calamities and disasters, especially on a personal level, but perhaps even one could say on a societal level, but more so again on an individual level. He says, do dua to the Almighty Allah. Have a conversation with the Almighty Allah. Ask help from the Almighty Allah. And it is this supplication that we do to the Almighty Allah, of course, who is our Creator, that many of the misfortunes and disasters that are befalling us or perhaps might befall us can be averted. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
Parts of Ziyarah Texts of Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
السلام عليك أيها النور الصافي السلام عليك أيها البدر الطالع
Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O Immaculate from among the Immaculate Ones. Peace be upon you, O Pleased and Pure. Peace be upon you, O Aba Ja'far, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the Righteous, the Pious, the Faithful Leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings be upon you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar was gripped by fear and chaos after a bomb ripped through a mosque situated close to the police headquarters. The injured were taken to the nearby hospitals by rescue workers. Crowds were seen hurrying to the blast site and hospitals in search of their loved ones.
We were assembled in the mosque for the evening prayers. I was among those who were ready to offer prayers. All of a sudden, a massive explosion occurred and the roof of the mosque collapsed suddenly.
After this attack, the government of Pakistan has vowed to fight back against terrorists until the last drop of their blood.
We will not spare those who want to sabotage the peace of the country. We will chase after them. All political stakeholders should sit together to maintain peace in the country.
Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan initially claimed responsibility for the attack. However, later they distanced themselves from the bombing, saying it was not their policy to target mosques, seminaries, and religious places. Experts say the Pakistani government needs to take up the issue of growing terrorism with neighboring Afghanistan. The Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan militants are said to be hiding in Afghanistan while carrying out attacks inside Pakistan once in a while.
This is really a source of great worry for Pakistan and the security forces of Pakistan. Pakistan was expecting that after the Taliban takeover in Kabul, the terrorism will go down and this tide of terrorism will subside. But that has not happened, unfortunately. The Taliban tried to broker a peace deal with between the government of Pakistan and TTP. Parleys were held, talks were held behind the scene between the security forces of Pakistan and the TTP leadership, but that didn't work.
The country's Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has appealed to the people for blood donations for the injured in a terrorist attack in Peshawar on Monday.
Pakistan is facing a resurgence of violent attacks in recent months. Analysts believe that government has to deal decisively with Taliban militants to maintain peace and economic stability of the country. Nasir Kazmi in Islamabad.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic Ummah kicked off in the capital Tehran on Sunday to discuss ways for the unity of the Islamic Ummah based on media activities. Media activists, managers and journalists from different Islamic countries attended the first Minaret International Conference held by Iran's World Forum for Proximity of Islamic Schools of Thought. The unity of the Islamic Ummah, media truth and media literacy, and the capacity of international media were the three major axes which were discussed by the participants at the first Minaret International Conference in Tehran.
I have taken part in the first conference on media and Islamic unity because I believe the media play a key role in shedding light on the atrocities of the oppressive regimes like Israel against Palestinians. Islamic media can keep the path of resistance alive and inform more people of what is happening against Palestinians in the occupied lands.
Moreover, the participants in the event, in a statement, condemned the recent insults to the Holy Quran and Islamic sanctities in European countries.
In today's world, media outlets play an important role in creating a campaign against a nation, religion, or belief. Western media centers have become the centers for waging war against other countries. The recent sacrilegious moves in European countries against the Holy Quran originates from the same policy. The insulting move hurt the feelings of billions of Muslims and provoked hatred and discord.
The statement also condemned Western governments for planting the seeds of hatred and animosity and fanning the flames of violence in the world. It underscored that Muslims based on their religious beliefs never allow themselves to insult the sanctities of other faiths, and that the followers of Islam hold all divine books and prophets in high respect.
The first international conference on media and the unity of the Islamic world is aimed at building capacity, network, and raising awareness among Islamic nations with regard to international development, especially anti-Islam currents, which will further forge unity among Muslims worldwide. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kyiv and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP-T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP-T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. According to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has announced a series of punitive steps against Palestinians in response to Friday's shooting in East Al-Quds. The operation, which was carried out by 21-year-old Khaira Alqam from East Al-Quds, killed 7 Israeli settlers and wounded several others. The steps announced late on Saturday during a meeting of the Israeli cabinet included new moves to expand Jewish settlements. The cabinet, however, has not provided details on how settlements would be expanded. Other measures include granting gun permits to Israelis, a move seen as a green light to Israeli civilians' use of guns against Palestinians.
These are parts of more collective punishment, more aggression and crimes against Palestinians. They are speaking about home demolitions and stripping citizenship of the families of those who carry out such operations from the real owners of the land, and more such moves against the people of Al-Quds.
The cabinet also decided more punishments for the families of those who carry out shooting operations by deciding to demolish their homes. Early on Sunday, Israeli troops raided Atur neighborhood where martyr Khaira Alqam came from and sealed up the entrances of his family home in preparation for its demolition. The Israeli cabinet voted to revoke residency and citizenship rights of families of those who carry out shooting operations from Al-Quds and lands occupied in 1948.
The decisions of the Israeli cabinet are only about using much more violence, fierce violence against Palestinian people, and about consolidating the system of racial discrimination and occupation. Their decisions will not change much, and will not break the Palestinian resistance, And in my opinion, this government is failing and will continue to fail because fascism cannot prevail. And nobody can break the will of the Palestinian people to struggle to be free.
Friday's operation came only one day after Israeli forces shot dead 9 Palestinians during a raid on a refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. That brings to more than 30 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces since the start of this year.
Observers argue that the Israelis themselves should be now worried about the repercussions of the right-wing regime's policies, including the deadly raid on Jenin. They add that the Palestinians won't fear Netanyahu's further restrictions and collective punishment they already are used to under Tel Aviv's occupation. Mona Kandil for Press TV, occupied Ramallah.
Hundreds of angered Muslim protesters converged on the Swedish embassy in London to condemn the recent desecration of Islam's holy book. Protesters came from across the UK in order to make their upset clear and to pressure European governments to take anti-Muslim hate more seriously.
This is the latest example of a protest to take place as anger across the Muslim world remains incredibly high. This week alone, there have been numerous Quran-burning protests and promises by right-wing activists to continue the pressure. As the protests continue, the anger will continue to grow too.
Activists informed Press TV how their love for the Quran compelled them to act.
We live for Quran. The Quran is very respectful. The Holy Quran is not our word, not our book. It's the book from Allah, then has to be very respectful.
This should stop because this is our human right, as well as the European laws, as we are living in European continent. The European law states that every religion and their religious leadership must be respected.
On Monday, a Dutch politician tore apart a copy of the Holy Quran in the city of The Hague. It followed an incident in Sweden where a politician burned a copy of the Quran outside the Turkish embassy. These extremists have been receiving authorities' permission to conduct the heinous acts, even provided police protection under the guise of freedom of expression. Mosques, Muslim-strong residential areas and embassies belonging to Muslim countries have all been the target of these Islamophobic incidents. This blatant state facilitation of anti-Islam extremism has led many Muslims to feel vulnerable in a continent which claims to defend minority and religious rights. Robert Carter, London.
Geomatics is not a well-known term amongst the public, but it's actually the driving force behind many of the daily activities in man's modern life. The second Iran Geo Exhibition offers a quick glance into the rapidly growing sector and Iran's latest products in the field.
Geo means earth, and geomatics is a science and technology that deal with the collection, distribution, and analysis of geographic data using aerial and satellite imaging. To put it simply, when you take an online cab, you're using a geomatic technology known as GPS, which is short for Global Positioning System.
Geomatics has its traces in almost all economic sectors, from mining to oil and gas. It's used for air navigation services, archaeological excavation, climate change and environmental monitoring, disaster risk reduction, and estimation of crop yields. Over the past decade, an increasing number of tech firms in Iran have expressed interest in geomatics.
We develop aerial imaging and surveying technologies. We also offer geophysical services. Here in this expo, we're showcasing our imaging and surveying drones, which can draw maps and collect topographical data to facilitate mining operations.
As the organizer of the tech event, the Iranian Defense Ministry says it is planning to encourage more companies to operate in geomatics to turn the strategic field into a viable source of income
for the country.
The world is shifting toward new and strategic technologies. Our country, too, is treading on the same path. Geomatics and its associated technologies have numerous applications. They are a major factor in advancing our space program. So, we invited major brands to this expo to help us achieve our goals by advancing geomatics in our country.
Organizers say during the 4 days of the second Geomatics exhibition, B2B meetings will be organized between investors and manufacturers. The event will also hold workshops for startups to acquaint them with the needs of the market.
Without Geomatics, many businesses such as online ride-sharing services would not exist. Experts here say the range of applications of this discipline is growing even wider, and this will attract larger investment to this field in the near future. They say this global trend is already happening in Iran. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis are urging their government to take decisive action to end the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen before the month of Ramadan begins. Due to Saudi Arabia's strangling blockade, food, fuel, and gas prices increased drastically during the holy month. Here at the Al Sanaa market, where many Yemenis do their shopping, customers said they want their government to adopt measures that will resuscitate Yemen's economy and end the continuous price hikes.
The strangling blockade is why food prices are increasing. When prices increase, it makes life harder for business owners.
We ask our government to improve our ballistic missile capability because it is our missile capability that will break the siege.
According to Mohammed Miftah, who is an advisor to the president of Yemen's Salvation Government, the cabinet's main task is to keep Yemen's battered economy afloat in the midst of a brutal war.
The government's main task, given the current circumstances, is to provide essential services like electricity, water, and building roads so people can travel. It's true, prices remain high. However, in the near future, the government aims to provide services at a lower price. In general, the main cause of the surge in prices is the Saudi blockade.
Mohammed Miftah says, despite the surge in prices, the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen's economy is leading to nowhere.
The enemy was hoping to strangle Yemen's economy completely by preventing all fuel and gas from entering Yemen. We have successfully foiled this plan, and now fuel and gas are available, even though they're slightly overpriced. The important thing is that they're available, which is more important.
For the time being, the Yemeni government shows a willingness to engage in peaceful political dialogue to end the war. However, much of the public has lost hope in the peace process.
Yemeni people are calling on the Salvation Government to break Saudi Arabia's siege on the country before the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a has called on Riyadh to lift the blockade multiple times. The kingdom has so far refused the requests, which means Yemen's next option could be a military one. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The memory of the rape and murder of pedestrian Sarah Everard in 2020 by then Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins is seared on everybody's mind here. The police commissioner at the time, Cressida Dick, called it a case of a few bad apples in the force and promised action to weed them out. She was soon forced to resign, leaving a police force in crisis. The latest scandal to rock the mat, David Carrick, an officer from the same unit as Wayne Cousins, pleading guilty to tens of offenses, including rape against 12 women over nearly two decades. The response from the new commissioner, Mark Rowley, an apology and the promise of a cleanup. Yet critics of the Metropolitan Police Force say they don't think that will solve the problem.
I think the proposition that it's just a few bad apples has been blown completely out the water. What we have in reality is a deeply systemized culture of misogyny and racism that speaks and exists at the very heart, the core of the Metropolitan Police Service. It is beyond reform. It is beyond saving.
The force Commissioner Rowley commands was placed under special measures last year after revelations of bullying, racial discrimination, and misogyny among some of its officers against people inside and outside the force. New anonymous revelations from serving police officers speak of a culture of racism and sexual abuse in the force, which has left some black staff suicidal.
The issue is that systematized culture actually targets and alienates black and ethnic minority officers. And that has a profound impact upon their family life, their mental health, their physical health. And we've seen examples, haven't we, time and time again, of black officers suffering life-changing, transforming trauma as a consequence of facing racism in the Met.
These are dark days for Britain's largest police force, with confidence in policing already at an all-time low. And the recent admission by one of its own will worsen trust in the people who are supposed to be protecting society. Cyper is up, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
The Zionist regime's medical blockade of Gaza has been described as one that gravely breaches residents' rights to health care in Gaza and outside. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Monitor wrote in this regard, Gaza's health ministry accused the Zionist regime of delaying the entry of several X-ray machines needed to treat patients in the blockaded Palestinian territories, Reuters reports. The ministry said requests in the past 14 months for 8 different types of X-ray machines and spare parts to repair existing equipment had been rejected or delayed. Dozens of other X-ray machines were allowed into the impoverished coastal enclave during the same period. The fabricated regime of Israel, which together with Egypt maintains a blockade around Gaza, citing security concerns, says it is worried about groups commandeering such machines for other purposes. Health Ministry Director Medhat Abbas said the equipment was funded by international relief and medical institutions on behalf of hospitals in Gaza. Abbas told Reuters, holding back the entry of that equipment caused a delay in providing medical services to thousands of patients. Requests for such equipment, COGAT told Reuters, are examined on a case-by-case basis. Abbas said the Zionist regime's assertions about the medical equipment having dual uses were a lie. At Gaza City Shifa Hospital, Nalat Zaino, 51, said she had been waiting 45 days to have an X-ray done of her kidneys. Doctors blamed the delay on the withholding of equipment. As if the pain I am feeling wasn't enough, waiting has been another form of torture, the mother of four told Reuters outside the X-ray unit. The ensuing blockade, limiting the amount of goods crossing in and out, has crippled Gaza's economy and healthcare system, which suffers from a chronic shortage of hospital beds and medical equipment. Meanwhile, Arab News reported the Zionist regime's ban is not limited to medical equipment needed for hospitals in Gaza. It is also preventing the entry of spare parts for broken equipment in Gaza and the transfer of equipment for repair outside. Gaza's health ministry accused the Zionist regime of exposing patients in intensive care and those with cancers, heart diseases, strokes, and complex fractures to health risks, as they are being deprived of devices that identify health problems and the required medical interventions. The Ministry of Health called on the relevant bodies to put direct pressure on the Zionist regime to bring in medical and diagnostic equipment and spare parts for broken equipment to save patients in the Gaza Strip from the guillotine of the occupation and the blockade by providing for their full treatment needs. Patients are forced to transfer to other hospitals outside the Gaza Strip, including hospitals in Al-Quds or the West Bank, and some in Egypt and Jordan, in order to obtain a diagnosis before starting treatment due to the lack of medical equipment. Samir Abu Al-Ain, 55, said he had to wait for 2 months until he obtained a medical referral and an Israeli permit to travel to Al-Quds for examinations at Augusta Victoria Hospital. Abu Al-Ain told Arab News, "I was diagnosed with cancer several months ago. Before that, there were suspicions on the part of the attending physician, but he was unable to identify the disease until after I got a diagnosis in Al-Quds, and I had to wait a long time until I got the necessary papers." He added, "It is not enough that we suffer from diseases, we suffer from waiting also, and the fear that treatment will not be available. Many of the medicines that the doctor prescribed for me are often not available, and I have to wait a long time until they are. Obtaining a medical referral to hospitals outside the Gaza Strip involves a long series of bureaucratic procedures." The Palestinian Center for Human Rights warned of the serious repercussions resulting from the Zionist regime's continued block on import equipment, which is needed to save the lives of thousands of patients in the Gaza Strip hospitals. Patients also suffer while waiting for a pass from the Zionist regime to Al-Quds and the West Bank, with dozens of them facing the Zionist regime's security bans. The primary responsibility for providing medical supplies to the population of the Gaza Strip lies with the Zionist regime's occupation, according to Articles 55 and 56 of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, said the center. More than 2.3 million people in Gaza depend on governmental health facilities to receive treatment, while these facilities suffer from serious deterioration as a result of the blockade policy imposed by the Zionist regime occupation authorities on the Strip for more than 15 years, it said. The center added that the internal Palestinian division resulted in the fragility of the health system and a permanent shortage in the list of essential medicines and medical devices, in addition to the shortage of specialized medical staff.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati,
there is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the lives and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shia dignitaries and scholars. I am Atan, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House Al-Qom, Shaykh Rouhani and Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
And Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum to you.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding Shiite Fuqaha, Imami Faqih of the late 6th century Hijra. He is no one but Muhammad ibn Mansur ibn Ahmad ibn Idris Hilli, mainly known as Ibn Idris, the author of As-Sara'ir. So, Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. This episode, give us some information about the early life and background of Ibn Idris al-Hilli.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Muhammad ibn Mansur ibn Ahmad ibn Idris al-Hilli, which is known as Ibn Idris, yes, was one of the Imami jurists living in the 6th Islamic century. And actually, he was... He died in Hilla, one of the cities of Iraq, and buried there, I think. So he was one of the offsprings or the grandchildren of Shaykh Tusi, rahmatullahi alayh. And among the teachers of this outstanding scholar, we can mention Abdullah ibn Ja'far, ibn Zuhri, Halabi, ibn Shahr al-Shub. These are the great scholars who were among the teachers of Ibn Idris al-Hilli.
Yes.
Then among the students of him also there are very well-known scholars like Fakhar ibn Ma'di Musawi, Ja'far ibn Nammab al-Hassan, Ali ibn Ahya Khayyat, and the other scholars.
Okay.
So he wrote lots of books. One of them is Sara'ir, and the other one is Khulasatul Istidlal fi al-Mawasi'ati wal-Mudayaqa. Al-Mukhtasar fi al-Mudayaqa, Risala fi Ma'na al-Nasib. So these are, of course, the works written by Ibn Idris al-Hilli.
That's right.
And one of the important points that could be mentioned regarding Ibn Idris al-Hilli is that Sheikh Tusi rahmatullah alayh was a very great and outstanding scholar in the history, in a way that after the demise of Sheikh Tusi, the other students and followers of Sheikh Tusi could not criticize his ideas, his viewpoints.
Or his method of research, his method in fiqh was specific to him, okay?
They said for 120 years, no one could criticize or oppose the ideas or the methods of Sheikh Tusi. And it was the Ibn Idris Hilli, the first important scholar of Shia, who criticized some of the viewpoints, some of the ideas of Sheikh Tusi.
That's right.
Actually, he encouraged the rest of the scholars to be critical in regards with the ideas and the theories developed by the other scholars.
Okay.
So actually, we can say that he developed and improved the Shiite, let's say, sciences or knowledges and the history. Okay. That's why his role is very much important into the development of different sciences and the history of Tashayyu.
And what was Ibn Idris's main approach that made him different from the followers of Sheikh Tusi regarding fiqh, Sayyid Mohsen?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously, after Sheikh Tusi, we could say he was a great scholar, like Sheikh Tusi was a great scholar. And no one had the courage to basically argue against what he has, you know, brought in his book, or the fiqh or jurisprudential, you know, the rulings that he has brought. So Ibn Idris was the first person who, after 120 years, did so. The main approach was the because he was following the intellect and he brought intellectuality in the fiqh or jurisprudence.
Okay.
You know, the reason is, you know, when we talk about the jurisprudence or the fiqh, some of the ulama, they just follow the narrations. And whatever is in the narrations, they use that. On the other hand, we have another group of ulama who use the narrations. And on top of that, they analyze the things, you know, according to the time.
According to the time.
They're the changes. For example, if it is...
So, you want to say that it was changed from a static approach to a dynamic one.
Dynamic approach, yes.
That's right.
So, Ibn Idris was the first scholar who came up with this idea. And obviously, that's why he had some arguments... or differences in the fiqh, which was different from the ideas which was provided by Sheikh Tusi.
Sheikh Tusi,
and due to this, some has, you know, basically tried to devalue his works. But on the other hand, we know that the
ulama... Or it's better to say choose a different approach.
Yes, it was a different approach.
Tusi, that's right, okay.
And this opened a door for the Shia school of thought to go towards the ijtihad. You know, the ijtihad was... going down, but he raised up, he boosted the level of ijtihad after 120 years of passing of, you know, Sheikh Tusi. So this was the main approach that he had in his books, which has opened. And after that, we can see day by day the advancements that we have in the Shia ijtihad. We can say the main person who has started this after Sheikh Tusi is Ibn Idris.
Oh, that's all right. So, as you said, the great point that you made. So, in order to adjust the fiqh rulings with the we can say necessities of the time, the time and era. This was what Ibn Idris was after, and As-Sarair was such a book, isn't it?
Yes.
Sheikh Rouhani, explain a little bit more, because this is believed to be the magnum opus of Kitab al-Sarair by Ibn Idris.
Yes, you know that fiqh or jurisprudence is one of the very, we can say the most significant field of studies in Islam is jurisprudence.
Yes.
And when it comes to jurisprudence, of course, different scholars, they try to get the most authentic fatwa. When they issue, for example, a fatwa or they explain a hukm of Islam, they should make sure themselves that this hukm or this ruling or assertion
that they assert regarding a certain thing, it should be trustable, it should be true, it should be valid, you know. So that is why in different centuries, so different scholars might experience or might test different kind of methods. Yes. So the methodologies of the studies by different scholars might be different.
Okay.
But the point is that, for example, when it comes to the people like Sheikh Ibn Idris Hilli,
yes,
who lived, for example, in the 6th century, of course, he should not be only a follower,
mm-hmm,
of the other scholars. Because in Shiite teachings among the Shia scholars, we have ijtihad. Ijtihad means that you should try your best, you yourself, mm-hmm, to find out the most authentic ahkam of Islam based on your own method,
mm-hmm,
based on your new kind of methods, which should be compatible with the needs of your time.
Yes.
So that's why this way we can say that Ibn Idris Hilli played a very great role into, yes, the advancement and development of the Shiite jurisprudence.
That's right.
Though, for example, he followed in many areas the Sheikh Tusi and other, yes, scholars, but in some specific areas he had his own ideas, mm-hmm, his own viewpoints, mm-hmm, his own, let's say, judgment, yes, about the methods and the ideas and the fatwa of the other scholars. So it paves the ground for the rest of the scholars in the coming centuries to do the same thing and to improve and to develop actually the ijtihad in the fiqh of Islam or in the Islamic jurisprudence.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah. Just entering the topics, the miscellaneous topic into a fiqhi book, like for example, usul, fiqhul lugha, rijal, you know, diraya, fiqh al-mugharan, or we can say akhlaqi points beside the other, make As-Sarai a very dynamic book and beautiful to read, isn't it?
Yeah, so obviously when he's using the intellect, uh-huh, and he wants to analyze the things according to the time,
yes,
he has no other choice than, you know, bringing these things. And this was one of the significant things that he did. For example, when he was talking about a jurisprudential law or a fiqhi rule, he was first argumenting on the principles of jurisprudence, okay, which is related to that, the usul,
yes,
that were made. And after that, in many things, for example, when we have the, you know, terminologies, he used to go towards the lughat, uh-huh, of the Arabic.
Very good.
And try to find the main meaning of that word.
Okay.
And then try to talk about that. You know, similarly, we had this, for example, you know, we have many scholars who, when they bring the, you know, the Islamic ruling, they first discuss the meaning of the word from different aspects. And then which meaning is being, you know, taken. This is very important because, you know, one word and its meanings can change many things. For example, okay, you know, in the Quran, the first verse is Bismillah.
Okay.
And there's a letter ba in the beginning. It, mm-hmm, has 22 meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Which one to take? Do I need to take the meaning of with, in relation to? Mm-hmm. You know, letter ba has different,
yes,
meanings.
So yes,
these things have, obviously, this has effects. And this is the main major, we can say, effect when we see a difference of opinion in many, you know, jurisprudential rules and laws, for example. And on top of that, you know, rijal was important. Obviously, the narrators who are narrating this, you know, particular narration from which we want to, you know, tell people a rule, an Islamic rule, because, you know, Islamic rule means that you either say people that this is an obligation, you need to perform this,
okay,
it is wajib, and if you do not perform such a thing, then obviously it is haram. So the,
okay,
the fiqh is basically,
yes,
around the halal, haram,
yes,
mubah,
yes,
something which is, you know, allowed, mustahab, and makruh. So basically, this is important that the narration that you're taking, it should be from an authentic source. It cannot be without that.
Yes.
And on top of that, obviously, the major difference of Ibn Idris from the others was in the chapter of Dirayah, where, you know, he never believed on Khabar al-Wahid. You know, we had this discussion
before,
that a single, we can say, you know, source is not accepted.
Yes.
If it is from one person. So there are many other things, obviously. And on top of that, you know, the fiqh al-maqarin.
Yes.
Fiqh al-maqarin means the fiqh or the jurisprudence or laws of this time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was something at the time of the Prophet.
Yes.
But now, for example, you know, when the thief was, you know, arrested at that time, there was another type of punishment.
The punishment was different.
But now, can we apply the same or not?
Okay.
Or we need to change.
Yes.
Or there are many other things
that
we have. So these discussions were basically brought by Ibn Idris into the fiqh.
You know, in a chapter in his book called Tamfizul Ahkam, on that time he talks about, for example, the main leader of a society, a person who is going to, at the time of ghaibah, of an infallible imam, you know, be in charge of a Muslim land and a Muslim society. What are the priorities? What are the conditions for such a man? And he tackled this issue. Maybe some people think that, for example, the concept of wala tafaghi is something new, but, you know, Ibn Idris has tackled it. Also, we can say jihad. What is jihad? All in all, as you said, istidlal, argumentation, istinad, documentation, you know,
the fiqh al-maqarin, which is, you know, between the different school of thoughts.
That's all right. Okay. So, Sheikh Rouhani, anything missed about Al-Sarair and these,
yes,
you know, fatwas?
You rightly mentioned, one of the very important concepts that is dealt with by Ibn Idris Hilli is Wilayat al-Faqih, because he is of the view that we cannot suspend or conceal or cancel, for example, the rulings of Islam at the time of ghaibah.
Yes.
So, of course, first it is the Imam al-Ma'soom who be, for example, the ruler. But of course, if there is no access to Imam al-Ma'soom directly in the Asr al-Ghaibah in the major occultation, so of course, at this time, fuqaha, the jurists, should take this responsibility and of course should rule over the people, and the people should actually follow and obey whatever is ruled by or issued, whatever fatwa, for example, or hukm is issued by the Shia jurist. So that's why he was of the view that in each and every kind of areas like economic, social, political, or religious kind of affairs, we have to refer to jurists, and whatever jurist actually issued the hukm or assert a hukm, we have to follow.
That's all right. Thank you very much for a nice elaboration. He passed away in the year 597 or 98, according to the Sol Hijri calendar, in Hilla, in a neighborhood called Jama'ain in Hilla. And we know that Hilla, beside Najaf, you know, Qoms, Mashhad, you know, Karbala, is again one of the most outstanding cities that has produced outstanding scholars, Shiite scholars, during the history of Islam. And so many great scholars like Ibn Idris Hilli are from that region. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man and the author of As-Sarair, Ibn Idris Hilli. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program, The Teacher. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode, introducing another Shiite dignitary. God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.